asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. South Africa's governing ANC has confirmed it's formally asked President Jacob Zuma to resign. The ruling party says the president is currently only agreeing to step aside in the next 3 to 6 months. If President Zuma continued to refuse to quit in the face of this recall by the ANC, he could face a vote of confidence in parliament. Jacob Zuma has faced long-running corruption allegations, which he denies. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says there should be a further livening up of what he describes as the warm climate of reconciliation with South Korea around the Winter Olympics. There's been a cooling in tensions on the peninsula with a North Korean delegation in the south for the Games. Although there's suspicion in the US, Pyongyang may be trying to divert attention from its weapons programs, South Korea's President Moon Jae-in says the US is open to talking with the North. The alleged mastermind of an audacious bank heist has gone on trial in France nearly half a century after the crime was committed. The gangster wrote about the robbery 8 years ago under an assumed name, but now prosecutors are trying him for money laundering. From Paris, Paul Barber reports.
It's been dubbed the heist of the century. A gang of thieves spent months tunnelling in sewers beneath a branch of the Société Générale Bank in the southern French city of Nice. They made off with the equivalent of $36 million after breaking into the bank's safe and hundreds of safety deposit boxes. Only one man was ever arrested for the 1976 robbery, but now Marseille organised crime boss Jacques Cassandry may find justice catching up with him. He wrote of the heist in a 2010 book under a pen name. Investigators concluded Cassandry was the burglary's mastermind, but he could no longer be tried for it. So now he's in the dock for money laundering. Paul Barber, Paris.
The Commonwealth is reported to be secretly considering who might succeed Britain's Queen Elizabeth II after her death. The 91-year-old monarch has headed the group since her coronation in 1953. The position, though, is not hereditary and will not therefore automatically pass to her son, Prince Charles. From London, Catherine Drew.
A high-level group of Commonwealth officials are meeting in London Tuesday for an all-day summit. The BBC has seen the agenda and is reporting a discussion entitled Wider Governance Considerations is code for the topic of who will succeed the Queen as head of the organisation on her passing. The Queen, who will be 92 years old in April, became head of the group in 1953 when she was head of state for 7 of its 8 members. Today she is head of state in 15 of the 53 member nations that make up the Commonwealth. While some may believe there is no realistic alternative to Prince Charles, others are thought to want to improve the organisation's reputation by taking a more democratic approach. She is due to attend the Commonwealth's Head of Government meeting, which is being held in London in April. Catherine Drew, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thank you very much, Ollie Barrett. Thank you indeed. Welcome to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. It is the 13th of February 2018. You can tweet me at any time between now and the end of the programme. As usual, it's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. That's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. I've got a terrific programme lined up for you this Tuesday. Thanks for choosing it. Thanks for joining me. Let's get on with it.
Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv. It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, I have to confess, I wasn't listening to the news because I was doing something else. Did they mention the story breaking in Tel Aviv? Maybe they didn't. Maybe it was a bit too soon for them. But Israeli police have recommended that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be charged over alleged bribery cases. That's coming out of Israeli media. How interesting is that? Although a number of you expressing on Twitter that you don't believe he'll ever be arrested. I suppose we'll have to wait and see. I've got a very interesting programme lined up for you tonight. I really do. UK listeners of a certain age will remember that in October 1986, Jeremy Bamber was sent to prison for life without the possibility of parole because he was convicted of murdering five members of his family. This came to be universally known as the White House Farm Murders. I was 12 at the time, and I do remember it. Incredibly, it was covered as much by the Irish media as it was by the UK media. The sort of thing that you just weren't used to at the time. Now, he's always maintained his innocence, even always. And today, tonight, we're joined by Michael O'Brien, who's an extraordinary man, Michael. He spent 11 years in jail for a murder he did not commit. His wrongful conviction was quashed, thank God, even though he spent 11 years in prison. And he went on to claim £300,000 in compensation from Welsh police. That was in an out-of-court settlement. An amazing story. Michael's is, it probably didn't feel very much amazing when he was in prison. But he got to know Jeremy Bamber at Longlarton Prison between 1989 and 1996. And he is a patron of a group that has long campaigned for justice for Jeremy Bamber, people who believe that Bamber is the victim of a gross miscarriage of justice. Michael joins the programme in around about 30 minutes' time, an extended conversation. He'll tell us why he believes that Jeremy Bamber, who has spent 33 years in prison now, is it? Something like that, 32, 33 years in jail. Michael will tell us why he's convinced the man is innocent. That's going to be incredibly interesting. That comes up a little bit later on. There isn't much more to be added to the news that the Israeli police have recommended that Benjamin Netanyahu be charged over alleged bribery cases. We've been reporting for a number of weeks now that at weekends, activists in their thousands have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and demanded that Netanyahu resign over those allegations that have been hanging over him. When he was questioned by the police last month, Netanyahu was bullish, he was boastful, he certainly wasn't humble, and he said nothing will happen because there is nothing. But again, that news breaking just as we came on air, Israeli media saying the police will announce that there is enough evidence to indict Netanyahu for bribery and breach of trust in two separate cases. Moving on. Big story here today, covered by everybody. It's been on television and radio all day. The ex-football coach Barry Bennell has been found guilty of multiple sex offences against boys in the 1980s. There was a huge media presence at Liverpool Crown Court today, and they heard that Bennell had a power hold over aspiring players aged between 8 and 15, and he abused them on an industrial scale. The 64-year-old was convicted of 36 charges, including indecent and serious sexual assaults. The jury did not reach verdicts on 7 counts. They will continue their deliberations tomorrow. Bennell wasn't there. He was witness to this via video link. Now, boys were abused at his home, where he had arcade games and exotic pets, including a puma and a monkey, on trips away and in his car on the way to and from training. The youth scout and junior football coach was associated with clubs including Stoke City, Manchester City and most notably Crewe Alexandra. In his evidence to the court, one victim, Chris Unsworth, said that Bennell had raped him about half a dozen times. Now, Sky News reporter Enda Brady has been following the case and sent this report back a short time ago.
Well, today was day 4 of the jury deliberating its verdicts here at Liverpool Crown Court in what has been a harrowing 4-week trial of Barry Bennell, a 64-year-old man who, from the very outset of this trial, the court was told, had convictions for child sex offences. His defence argued that this made him a sitting target for people to come forward and make allegations against him. The prosecution had told the jury last week, when they went out to begin their deliberations last Thursday morning, that here was a man who was a child molester on an industrial scale. That is what the prosecution had argued. Just before 4 o'clock this afternoon, the six women and five men on the jury filed back into court, and they delivered guilty verdict after guilty verdict against Barry Bennell. 36 charges in total, all guilty. There are seven still outstanding, and the judge has now sent the jury home for the evening. They will return to court at 10:15 tomorrow morning to resume their deliberations on those seven outstanding charges. Some of the men who were abused by Bennell were in the public gallery, and some of them wept. There was a lot of emotion in the courtroom. Bennell is not here. He has been following proceedings via a video link from prison. He is ill and he has not attended court, and he did not give any evidence in his own defence, which was his right. But the prosecution said that you could draw your own conclusions from that. So the case will continue now. The jury will come back here tomorrow morning and resume their deliberations on the remaining seven charges.
Enda Brady, so why is the Richie Allen Show interested in this? Well, because there are a lot of unanswered questions about Bennell. They said he was operating on an industrial scale. That evokes images of Jimmy Savile. How could he have done this? How could he have had exotic pets like pumas and monkeys at his house and arcade games and be bringing young boys, young football playing boys, back to his house to be abused on an industrial scale without people knowing? Was Barry Bennell part of a network? Was he? Were there other people involved? Has he protected people? People must have known what Bennell was doing. That's why I was very interested in that case and followed it today. These are, sadly, questions that are not going to be asked by the UK media. But they're serious questions, aren't they? I mean, you're talking to a guy who covered the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal in Ireland. And we know now that, you know, dozens and dozens of priests who didn't abuse children, who did not abuse children, knew what was going on but kept quiet. We know that bishops and cardinals told told those priests who didn't do it that they were not to speak about it to the police if they were ever questioned, and that the offending priests were to be moved around the country elsewhere. The Barry Bennell story, I think, is one we're only getting half of, if that. Anyway, moving on. Oxfam, the charity, is all over the news again today, as you'd expect. It's everywhere today. You know now the charity has been accused of covering up incidents where its staff used prostitutes in Haiti and had sex with, allegedly had sex with, underage girls, which is child abuse. The story took a kind of a bizarre twist today. The chairman of the charity Oxfam International, of course another branch, Juan Alberto Fuentes, he's been arrested in Guatemala. Now, he was detained there as part of an investigation into a corruption scandal dating back to his time as Guatemala's finance minister. No charges have yet been brought. The arrest isn't related to his role at Oxfam, but of course it heaps further pressure on the charity, which is under all sorts of scrutiny, or at least it appears that it is, over the last couple of days. Now, Channel 4 News and Sky News ran interviews with the former head of safeguarding at Oxfam, a woman called Helen Evans. She's been saying that she told the charity that volunteers were being abused at Oxfam shops in the UK, and they were being abused by men who were not vetted, no background checks. So the parents of teenagers who volunteered at Oxfam's high street shops didn't know they were working with men whose background had not been looked into before being allowed to volunteer at the shops. Now, Helen Evans blew the whistle on this back in 2015, and you can hear a little bit of Sky News report, and you'll hear from her. This is her speaking today.
It was me initially working on this 4 days a week, and then I had 3 days a week of admin support. And I asked repeatedly, we need more resource, we need more resource for this. And it wasn't forthcoming.
Helen Evans says Oxfam was not carrying out the criminal record checks it needed to conduct on those working in its shops.
And the point I made repeatedly, our parents are trusting these organisations to keep their children safe when they volunteer. These are 14-year-old children. And if parents knew that those adults were not checked, they would not be sending those children into those shops.
Oxfam says it regrets not acting on Helen's concerns much quicker and with more resources.
What I can't understand is how in the period that she's talking about, with respect to everything that was previously known about the dangers of unvetted men working with youngsters, how could Oxfam justify in 2009, 10, 11, 12 that men could work in their shops with minors and those men weren't vetted? It is preposterous to me, and I don't believe you can put it down to, well, it was an oversight and it was just a mistake. So what are you saying then, Richie? I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying I don't believe that it's a mistake. I really don't. It's beyond the pale, that, you know, and it's beyond the pale that the parents of those children wouldn't have known about that. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper has reported this afternoon that the aid official who has been embroiled in the sexual misconduct scandal at Oxfam, he had allegedly been forced out by another British charity 7 years earlier following an investigation into the use of sex workers. Again, how does this happen? How does a guy get turfed out of a charity amid a sex scandal and then go to work at a major international charity, one of the most famous, Oxfam? How is that possible? The Guardian newspaper writes today, Roland van Houwermeeren, that's the man, he agreed to leave his job working for the charity Merlin in Liberia in 2004 following an investigation into sex parties with local women. And that's according to the humanitarian news website IRIN. Now, Merlin is a medical emergency relief charity which has since merged with Save the Children. So Merlin got rid of this guy, right? Because he was having sex parties while he was supposed to be doing humanitarian work in Liberia. And he ends up at Oxfam. He went on to Chad. And then he went on to Haiti, where he's alleged to have used sex workers. It's also alleged that underage children were abused as well. Again, you can't tell me that it's just one of those things, you know, people were, their attention was diverted somewhere else and they just didn't know. They must have known what this guy was doing in Liberia when he was with Merlin. It's a scandal, isn't it? But we're not going to get the whole story, or anything like the whole story. Number of you are saying on Twitter now that, you know, you see this being covered up. You see the politicians, the current International Development Secretary Penny Mordaunt and former International Development Secretaries, they're all playing see no evil, hear no evil. Sing dumb. Oh, we didn't know. Oh, nobody ever said anything to me. I think Justine Greening was interviewed today. She used to be the International Development Secretary, Greening. And she was, I don't recall anybody ever saying that people were being abused and that sex workers were being bought by Oxfam staff. I don't recall. It's not something that you recall. You either know or you don't know. You know? We'll leave that one alone. We talked a lot about that yesterday. I'm sure there'll be more revelations, at least from the independent media, as the week goes on. Julian Assange has been in the news at tea time today. An arrest warrant for Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, has been upheld by Westminster Magistrates Court. The warrant was issued when Assange breached bail conditions in 2012 by seeking political refuge at the Ecuadorian embassy, in case you don't remember. He was facing sexual assault allegations in Sweden. Those allegations were dropped last May. So nearly a year ago, those allegations were dropped. Now, Assange has been hiding, basically, in the embassy since 2012. He believes he'll be extradited to the United States. Owing to the warrant, Assange would be arrested as soon as he left Ecuadorian soil. But there's no extradition treaty between the UK and Ecuador, so they can't arrest him inside the embassy. Judge Arbuthnot, that must be Emma Arbuthnot, interesting woman. Not going to get into it. She described Assange as a man who wants to impose his own terms on the course of justice, whether the course of justice is in this jurisdiction or in Sweden. She said he appears to only consider himself above the normal rules of law and wants justice only if it goes in his favour. She said she didn't find Assange's fear that Swedish authorities would extradite him to the US reasonable, based on the fact that those charges were dropped last year. Are you fed up with Julian Assange? I'm a bit fed up with Julian Assange. I really am. I never bought into him. Something I said many times over the years, and I had a rather infamous interview with his right-hand man, Christian Rafnson, on TPV, where I basically accused him of not revealing anything of any great importance over the years. You were being spied on. Oh, Jesus, you could have knocked me down with a feather. Didn't know that one. Thank you very much. Never bought into them or Assange or his three-quarter length leather coats and his hairdo and his celebrity status. Never bought into it. Or that WikiLeaks revealed any important secrets. But I know when I say that, I'm going to trigger people. People don't like that. You're supposed to support Assange, but I've no interest in him, to be honest. This wedding that's taking place in May on FA Cup final day, we're going to have it till the end of May, right? You're sick to death of it. And I feel sorry. You know, I don't just feel sorry for the reporters who have to cover it, and it must be driving them mad with boredom covering this ginger kid and his American fiance. Do you know who I feel sorry for? I feel sorry for Major James Hewitt. Nobody is asking him how he feels about his kid getting married. I'm presuming he's going to watch it on the telly with Fergie, presumably. Now, the Independent newspaper on the wedding reports today that people sleeping rough in Windsor could be fined up to £100 under proposed measures to reduce the visibility of homelessness in the borough ahead of the royal wedding. This is sickening, isn't it? Eh? Issuing fines to people for £100 because they have gone looking for a cup of tea and left their sleeping bag behind them. That's £100 fine. It's ridiculous, of course, because they can't pay. They don't have any money. They're homeless. Windsor and Maidenhead Council writes the Independent wants to ban people from begging and from leaving their belongings and their bedding unattended on the street. The council hopes the robust strategy will reduce rough sleepers by 50% by the end of March. Just in time for Harry Hewitt and Meghan Markle's wedding at Windsor Castle on the 19th of May. It's going to ruin Cup final day. And you know the irony of this, talking about homeless people begging? Harry Freeloader and his record-breaking benefit-earning family are going to rock into town to get married on the taxpayer. And they want to demonise... No, they want to criminalise rough sleeping. I do hope those charities who've threatened that they'll take thousands of homeless people to the wedding, I hope they follow through on that promise, that threat. Get as many homeless people as you possibly can, promise them a dinner and a good day out, some music, get some bands in there and take over Windsor that day. That'd be absolutely brilliant. 22 and a half minutes past the hour. It is Tuesday, 13th of February, 2018. This is your Richie Allen Show, live on richieallen.co.uk, triggerwarning.tv, and of course fabradiointernational.com, the podcast hosted on Spotify, iTunes, Podomatic, and plenty of other places as well that I don't even know about. Get these messages from time to time that you're on a certain podcast website. I've no idea. I don't mind. Let people share it wherever they want. Now, here's an interesting story. You'll remember Professor Frank Faraday of Kent University. Frank was on this programme last year. Very interesting man, academic, author. He writes a lot about how majority cultures are being victimised by minority cultures. He's interested in that sort of stuff. Identity politics. He was very good. Now, Frank was speaking to RT in the last 24 hours. And apparently, Frank was present, presumably at some forum or other, or some meeting or some expo, whatever it was. But also at this meeting was George Soros himself, the manipulator, and some of Soros's friends, some of his lackeys. And Frank Faraday told RT that he was party to conversations where Soros and his mates were bragging about things they had done in Libya, in Tunisia, in Syria and elsewhere. Fascinating bit of audio. Frank Ferrady speaking with RT.
During the course of the conversation, they were going on about how much influence they've been able to exercise over events in the Arab Spring in Cairo. They were very proud of the role they played in Tunisia during the revolt there. They went on about the Ukraine, how much of an impact they were able to make on some of the demonstrators at the time. And then finally, they ended up by boasting about the fact that their role was critical and played a very important role in the case of Libya and the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime. And I kind of regarded the conversation as, you know, a bit of boasting. You know, when people get around a table, they often like to show off.
Yeah, but ironically, the things they were boasting about and the things they were claiming to do are things that independent journalists and writers and researchers have been accusing them of. You know, we don't believe in coincidences, do we? Right, what else is there to report on? Just very briefly before we take a break. The BBC are reporting that Prince Harry discussed trains with a boy in Edinburgh. Isn't that wonderful? It's massive news. It's on the BBC website now, bbc.co.uk/news. Prince Harry discusses trains with boy. Marvellous. Really good stuff. It's important that you knew that, so I'm glad I told you. Listen, more on the Netanyahu story. A police statement has said there is enough evidence to indict Benjamin Netanyahu for bribery, fraud and breach of trust. He was questioned last month. He said the allegations were baseless, but the police are saying no, they're not, and they are recommending that he faces charges. It's going to be very interesting to see this develop over the next 24 hours. Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. Very quick break. Back in a moment with some more. And don't forget, Michael O'Brien joins me to talk about why he believes Jeremy Bamber has spent 33 years in prison for a murder, or murders even, that he did not commit. You don't want to miss that. Back shortly.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markmajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today. Asking the questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
Welcome back. 28 and a half minutes past the hour. In about 3 minutes' time, I'll phone Michael O'Brien and we'll chat with Michael about his own amazing case. Remarkable man. I've got enormous respect for people like Michael O'Brien because I'm left kind of cold, you know. When people watch films, you know, sometimes horror films or very violent films can disturb them. But for me, the most disturbing films I've seen over the years are true stories about people who've been wrongfully convicted and have spent years in prison for something they didn't do. And it's often disturbed me that, wondering how could you possibly cope with that? How could you deal with it inside, knowing that you shouldn't be there? and that you've been stitched up and thinking that you're never going to get out of it. And I've interviewed many men and women over the years who have suffered that, and I never get tired, number one, of hearing their stories and celebrating with them the fact that they're out, but also, you know, highlighting the importance of, you know, us understanding that these miscarriages of justice, they go on all the time. And there are a lot of people in prison today, you can be sure of it, who shouldn't be there, who've been fitted up sometimes by somebody else, but often, it's sadly, often by bent legal professionals and by corruption in the police as well. I mean, it really is serious stuff. So we're going to talk to Michael, and we're really interested in hearing about him, but also why he's so convinced that Jeremy Bamber is innocent. I certainly have no axe to grind here. I really don't. I know the case of Jeremy Bamber. I know what he was convicted of, and I know he's been in prison for a long, long time. I do not believe in whole life tariffs or, you know, people being locked up with no chance of parole. I don't believe in that either, but that's another issue entirely. But I'm looking forward to speaking with Michael. We'll take some music. When we come back, Michael will be with me. And like I said, it'll be an extended chat. And on Twitter, if there's anything you'd like me to put to him, you need only tweet it to @RichieAllenShow. That's @RichieAllenShow on Twitter. All right. So here's Oasis then. At exactly 29 minutes to the top of the hour, this is She's Electric on your Richie Allen Show. Nothing like it. Thanks for joining me. Great to be with you this Tuesday. We're going to be speaking Miscarriage of Justice with Michael O'Brien coming up in exactly 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
She's electric. She's in a family full of eccentrics. She's done things I've never expected. And I need more time. She's got a sister. And God only knows how I've missed her. And on the palm of her hand is a blister. And I need more time. And I want you to know, got my mind made up now. But I need more time.
Music from Oasis, that's She's Electric on your Richie Allen Show. 27 minutes to the top of the hour. Let's get our guest on then. Without any further ado, you heard me say at the top of the programme that back in 1986, Jeremy Bamber was convicted of the murder of his adoptive parents, his sister and her six-year-old twin boys. It was a major case, massive case. You know, pre-internet and pre-social media, it was huge. Like I said earlier, it got as much coverage in the Republic of Ireland as it did in the UK, and I'm sure it got coverage all around the world. He was sentenced to, basically the prosecution argued that there was a financial motive behind the murders, that he wanted to secure for himself a large inheritance and that he tried to blame the murders on his sister. That's what the prosecution argued. And they argued successfully because, as I said, Jeremy Bamber was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, but he has always maintained his innocence. And he has tried on a couple of occasions, without success obviously, to have his conviction overturned. Now, let's welcome our guest to the programme this evening. I'm really looking forward to speaking with him. I have great admiration for him. I mentioned earlier on that he spent 11 years in prison for a murder he did not commit. How could you deal with that? And after his wrongful conviction, he quite rightly went after Welsh police, and they eventually paid him around £300,000 in compensation. Now, while he was in Longlaughlin prison, and that was in the late 1980s to the mid-1990s, he came to know Jeremy Bamber and was immediately convinced that Bamber has been the victim of a gross miscarriage of justice. It is a genuine honour to welcome to the programme Michael O'Brien. Michael, you're very welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Nice to have you on. And you know, when I say it's an honour, I mean that. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. I can't imagine what you went through. And I know it's been some years since you were released, but I suppose, Michael, something like that never leaves you. No matter how many years go by, you'll never forget your experiences being locked up for something you didn't do. Michael, how does any man deal with that? Being in prison, accused of murder, you didn't do it, you know you didn't do it. How did you survive that?
Well, the first couple of years I went through the drink and drug stage. Unfortunately, in the prison system, there's plenty of drugs you could get hold of. And I turned to the drink and the drugs to blot out what had happened to me. And it wasn't until 2 years later, when other victims of miscarriages of justice were in prison, like the Birmingham 6, Guildford 4, Cowbridge Water, you know, and some of these people guided me, you know, and helped me to get off the drugs and to fight back, you know. And I started educating myself when I was in prison because I didn't have no education. And then I started getting really angry. I thought, I'm not going to take this lying down, and I'm going to fight. And that's exactly what I did. You know, I enrolled on English class, maths class, anything I could think of which I could better myself so I could understand and fight the injustice which was laid upon me.
You met some extraordinary people, didn't you? You mentioned some of them there. Birmingham 6, Guildford 4, men who'd been, like yourself, fitted up and wrongfully convicted of, you know, terrible crimes. Obviously a huge inspiration to you, Michael. I want to talk, I want to talk about Jeremy Bamber, but I'm fascinated speaking to you about how you got through that initial period where you must have been suicidal. I know some very bad things happened when you were on remand. I know your daughter passed away. You had an awful lot to deal with. But meeting other men in the same situation as you was obviously very helpful to you. How do you know, Michael, when you speak with somebody, how do you know instinctively that they didn't do it? I mean, when you met these guys convicted of these terrible bombing campaigns, how did you know they didn't do it? I mean, we know they didn't do it, but how did you know at the time?
You get a gut instinct in the way they behave. I mean, the only thing on an innocent person's mind is getting out of prison, but clearing their name. You know, parole doesn't come into it. You know, a number of the people I've mentioned on here tonight would have probably already have got parole if they would have admitted their guilt. But they wasn't having it. I was the same myself. I was talked about that I would never get parole if I kept on protesting my innocence. And I said, well, so be it, that I'll die in prison then. You know, and that was my attitude, because that's how you know when somebody is innocent. You know, they're prepared to die in prison for what they know is right. And it was the same with the Birmingham Six. You know, everybody knew the Birmingham Six were innocent. They should have been out years and years ago. At the first appeal, I would say, you know, and if you can go back further than that, you can argue that they shouldn't even been convicted at all.
And you immersed yourself in your own education, which is a remarkable thing, and obviously learning, you start to learn the law as it applies to your own case. But it's still, the wheels of justice, Michael, they grind slowly, if they grind at all. And 11 years is a long, long time. I mean, once you started the process of fighting back hard, was there any time during that period that you got fed up, that you thought, Jesus, this is not going anywhere? Or did you believe once you started working on your case, once you started meeting people like that, were you always convinced you were going to make it?
I always believed that I was going to make it. I always believed that we were going to get our names cleared. And I can remember in 1991 when the Birmingham Six got cleared and I was watching it on telly and I was so pleased to see them released, you know, but wishing it was me as well. And I'm saying, well, if they can overturn their conviction, then so can I. And it inspired me, you know, Paddy, especially Paddy Hill. You know, he was a very inspiring figure. He still is today. You know, he's relevant in the miscarriage of justice world and people look up to Paddy because of what he's achieved. And I mean, that was the thing, seeing people getting freed, you know, the Guildford Four, C&M free, you know, the Cardiff Three, the Lynette White case, they got out before me as well. The Darvell brothers, just to name just a few. And I mean, when you look at them cases and you think you see them getting out, there's always hope. And as long as there's hope, you can fight. And yes, I did used to get depressed. I still do from time to time, you know, when I look back on my life and I think, did this really happen? You know, and it sends shudders through my body sometimes. But I've learned to live with it. And that's what you have to do. And it's the same as in prison. And I would advise anyone who's been wrongly convicted that you've got to fight back. You've got to educate yourself. It's so, so important. And I would like to mention, you know, the Craven too. That's another miscarriage of justice I've just got involved in. And, you know, if your listeners wanted to know more about that case, you know what I mean? It's justiceforthecraven2.com. You know what I mean? I'd like them to look at that because there's a petition on site. There's 4,000 people who've signed this case, you know, to say, you know, that they want the case referred back to the Court of Appeal. And it's the same as Jeremy Bamber's. If anybody wanted to look at Jeremy Bamber's case, it's www.jeremy/bamber.co.uk. And they're two cases which really, really worry me.
Yeah, we're going to talk about Jeremy now in a few minutes. And I will, of course, tweet out links to the sites there. By the way, it's, you know, I'm always mindful when speaking to someone like you, and there aren't too many people like you, Michael. We don't get to speak to too many people who've been wrongfully convicted of murder or any other serious crime. But you're walking, talking proof that those who wish to see capital punishment reinstated in this country, and it's always there, just beneath the surface. There are always people working on that. It's madness, because if the noose had still been in operation when you were convicted, you'd have been executed. It's very important to make that point. We should never, ever consider going back to capital punishment. No doubt you'll agree with that, Michael.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm patron of the Death Penalty Society, you know, in Britain, you know, because there's a number of cases in America, you know, which we've looked at before, and we have tried to stop people being executed. Unfortunately, we've been successful with some, but not all, you know, and I don't think we want to go down the American route. You know, it's a barbaric punishment. And once you've made that mistake of killing somebody, it's no use saying 20 years later then, oh, by the way, we know you're innocent now, we'll clear your name, but then you're 6 foot under. Now, what good is that to anybody? Once the mistake has been made, you cannot rectify it. And that's why the death penalty should have no place in a civilised society.
Absolutely right. I'm speaking with Michael O'Brien. By the way, Michael's website is Michael A, that's the letter A, O'Brien.com. Michael A. O'Brien.com. There's a lot on the website there, a lot of information. You'll find out a lot more about Michael there. Just on that, Michael, I interviewed John Thompson, who's a name probably does ring a bell for you. He's part of an organisation called Resurrection After Exoneration in the United States of America. That guy was only days away from the needle.
Team,
that's right, yeah. Only days after a corrupt district attorney hid blood evidence that would have exonerated John, and that guy was only days from having the needle stuck in his arm. There's no place for capital punishment. Michael was wrongly convicted. Thank God that conviction was quashed. He went after the people responsible. There was a settlement. We talked about that earlier on. Brilliant to have him on. So when and where did you meet Jeremy Bamber, Michael? When did that happen?
Well, it was in the early years. It was in 1989. I spent 7 years at Long Lat in prison, and it was there that Jeremy came onto our wing, and that's how I met him, because he was only a couple of cells up from me. And because I was working with other people who were saying they were innocent as well on their cases, we all seemed to have a little, we had a little group, and Jeremy was involved in that group. And I can remember Jeremy showing ballistic tests would show that it was impossible for him to have done it. And I mean, I was convinced of his innocence early on. He stood out like a sore thumb, you know, like I did. We were like little lost sheep, you know, that we just didn't belong there. And he stood out for me out of nearly all the prisoners who were there.
You knew, Michael, that everybody knew about Jeremy. I mean, I was 12 in Waterford City in Ireland. We got the UK channels, massive story. So you knew what he was convicted of. And in black and white, it's heinous. You know, whoever killed those people, it's a heinous thing in black and white. So you knew all about him anyway. So, but you kept an open mind and you were convinced from the get-go that this man was the genuine article, that when he said he was innocent, he meant he was innocent. He was innocent.
Well, he took me through a number of points in his case and for his appeal, you know, and it was this clear pointers to who actually committed this crime, you know. His sister, Sheila, you know, we feel was responsible for this crime, and all the campaigners do, you know. I mean, there was evidence that Sheila was still alive afterwards, and there's phone calls to the police, and the records all tally up with what Jeremy has said. You know, I'll give you an example. His father phoned up the police and said, "My daughter is going mad with a shotgun." You know, he didn't say Jeremy was going mad with a shotgun. He was adamant. And these records have still today have been withheld from Jeremy's legal team. Plus, there's also a lot of non-disclosure in this particular case. And there's a court order against the chief constable of Essex Police. And they're still refusing to release these things. Now, you've got to look at it from the point of view, like, when you go into a police station, the police say, "Well, if you've got nothing to hide, you will tell us everything." Well, our argument is, if the police got nothing to hide, give us everything. What is the difference?
Do you know what we'll do? We've got plenty of time, obviously. Let's go through what was alleged to have happened on the night in question. We're going back, of course, to August 1985, early August 1985. And what happened? Give us the without. Obviously, I know what you believe, but what is alleged to have happened? What is Jeremy alleged to have done over the course of those 2 days in early August?
Well, my understanding of the case is the police's case is basically, first of all, when they done the investigations, they believed it was an open and shut case. They believed that it was Sheila Caffell who used the gun and killed the members of the family, and Jeremy wasn't even thought of. But then some of the family members of Jeremy's who had, if you like, you know, they had something to gain by saying what they did, called the police and said they believed that Jeremy was the one responsible. And that's how the investigation turned from Sheila Caffell
to
Jeremy.
That was his partner at the time. What the police contended was Jeremy was adopted by Neville and June Bamber, and the police contention and the prosecution contention was that Neville and June were shot inside their farmhouse, along with Sheila, who was also adopted, who would have been Jeremy's adoptive sister, and also Sheila's two-year-old twin sons. Now, Jeremy, when this took place, Jeremy said that he was in his own house, which was a few miles away from the farmhouse where the shooting took place. Jeremy said that he got a phone call from Neville, from his adopted dad, to say that, you know, obviously terrible things were happening, and that's how he ended up on the scene. And as you said, initially the police did believe that Sheila, Jeremy's adopted sister, who had schizophrenia, they believed that she did fire the shots and did kill the others before turning the gun on herself. That was believed. But it was only, literally only a few weeks later, that Jeremy's girlfriend at the time told police that basically he had confessed to her that he did it. And that's when things obviously took a very dramatic turn. And you believe there are a lot of things that maybe the public don't know in terms of bits of evidence and things that happened that support the original belief that Sheila did do it, the girl with schizophrenia, that
Absolutely.
She did do it. Give us some of that information as best as you can then, Michael, please.
Well, I'll give you an example. You know, when Jeremy got the phone call from his father and it was logged by the police, those records have never been released to Jeremy Bamber's legal team. As I said, the big issue is non-disclosure, because there is evidence there, we believe, which would prove Jeremy what Jeremy's been saying all along. And I know Jeremy's might have a new appeal. Well, we're hoping for a new appeal, and I can't go into all the new evidence we have got, but I can say what was said at the time of the trial and what we have, the evidence we have got now, totally changes the picture of what they said about Jeremy at the trial. You know, I believe he's 100% innocent. He's taken a lie detector test, you know, a polygraph test, as they say. I took one myself to prove I was innocent. Jeremy passed with flying colours. I mean, there is, I'll give you an example. When the police searched the house, they were looking for the moderator from the gun. They didn't find it. And then all of a sudden, then this eagle-eyed police officer, 3 weeks later, just walks into the house and finds a moderator there. It's clearly been swapped. There's no doubt about it. And when they'd done the tests on the one moderator, the blood was apparently from Sheila's. And it also matched the main beneficiary of the estate. So, you know, these are the things you've got to look at. But in 2002, at the appeal, the scientists didn't find Sheila's DNA or the other person's DNA, because there was nothing there. So and the one person didn't even give a sample, which he should have. You know, so there is forensic reports which are supporting what Jeremy has said all along. As I said, I can't go into the nitty-gritty of the actual reports or whatever, but there is new evidence there, and it changes the picture, and it just shows that Sheila Coffell did commit this crime.
One of the things that is very interesting when you're looking through the timetable of events is the phone call from Neville to Jeremy. And the police obviously said at the time that this didn't take place. If it did take place, of course, there would have been a record of it. British Telecom would have a record of it. And sceptics, and I'm playing the devil's advocate here, Michael, I have no axe to grind, I have no dog in the fight, except as any, you know, any journalist, you want to see the truth come out. And I think these are questions
Absolutely.
That have to be asked. But people say, you know, that phone call, where if there's a cover-up, that cover-up would have to involve the telecom company as well. And people say, you know, a lot of people would have had to be involved in covering this up and placing the blame squarely at the feet of Jeremy. Why would they want to do that? That's what people say when the subject of Jeremy's innocence is raised. Why would people want to do that to him?
Well, I think that it all boils down to one thing. I think it boils down to money at the end of the day. If you look at the people who benefited from Jeremy being out of the way, and follow the money trail, then, you know, people can make their own minds up. You know, and we're talking about a significant amount of money in here. We're not talking, two pences and three pences. We're talking about big money, which Jeremy would have been entitled to. But with Jeremy out of the way, other people benefited because of that. And you have to look at that route as well.
He's coming up on 33 years in prison now, isn't he?
Yes, 33 years, yes.
What's his mental state like now, Michael? I mean, I can't imagine being locked away for several months. I mean, you had to do 11 years of your life for something you didn't do. What's his mental state like today, you know, after so long, being incarcerated for so long? How is he?
Well, he's obviously damaged by what has happened. I mean, what you've got to remember as well, he hasn't had a chance to grieve for his family. He's a victim in this too. You know, in two ways. Obviously, the victim of a miscarriage of justice, but he lost his parents. You know, he hasn't had proper time to grieve and go to the grave and put flowers and stuff like that. And this is what people also forget. Now, he's a strong character, Jeremy. You know, he is a strong character. I've got to be honest with you. He's got more strength than what I got, because I don't know whether I could have done 33 years. And then he's amazing. He's amazing how he's managed to keep fighting. He keeps fit. He tries to keep his mental well-being as best he can by going to the gym and stuff like this. I mean, you know, he's a very well-educated person. And, he's going to need help when he eventually comes out, because most people who suffer a wrongful conviction suffer personality traits. You know what I mean? That's what they do. It's called post-traumatic stress disorder. And Jeremy will be no different when he comes out to the outside world, and I believe he will do. I mean, he's going to need a significant amount of help.
You mentioned that, you know, he's strong-minded. I remember, I think it might have been The Guardian, it might have been The Independent, you'll correct me now one way or the other, but they kind of lent him some support in the mid-2000s, didn't they? And they were sympathetic to him and suggested that maybe his demeanour was one of the reasons why the public were unsympathetic to him. They kind of took up the baton for him for a time anyway. Does he still have that interest and support in the media, do you think? Do you think that the media is genuinely interested in the case to this day?
Yeah, well, you know, I took part in a documentary to do with Jeremy many years ago. I think it was 2003. And, you know, I put Jeremy's case as best I could on the television. And I was one of the few at the time, on that particular program who was sticking up for Jeremy. And I understand what people say about Jeremy's demeanor and the way he is. But I think they're getting the wrong impression. And I think the jury got the wrong impression, because when you look at Jeremy and you speak to him, he's very confident. But confidence can be misconstrued as arrogance, yeah, as well. And there's a fine line, you know. And I mistook Jeremy. I had a rollicking off Jeremy for saying some of the things I did. Like, he's not everybody's cup of tea, you know. And I didn't mean that in a nasty way. I meant it in the way that, you know, he can be misconstrued. And I think that's what it is with Jeremy. People take him the wrong way. But, you know, I mean, he is a nice guy. You know, he hasn't got a violent bone in his body. You know what I mean? He's not the type of person some of these tabloid press have made him out to be. You know, evil Bamba. And it really gets my goat, to be honest with you, because they don't know him at all. They've only gone by whatever the police have said, or the police reports and this said, you know. Why don't they go and write to Jeremy and speak to Jeremy, you know? This is the thing. And find out the true facts.
I want to do a quick recap, Michael. We're speaking with Michael O'Brien. Michael's a remarkable man, very well known in legal circuses. Excuse me, legal circuses. Yeah, legal affairs are often circuses. In legal circles, I should say, he's also well known in activism circles. You know, working on cases of people believed to be imprisoned wrongfully. He was wrongfully imprisoned for 11 years for a murder he did not commit. Thank God that was quashed back in 1999. He met Jeremy Bamber in prison. Jeremy was convicted of the murder of 5 members of his family. A very notorious case, this, back in 1986. The huge case at the time. It would have been massive news, this. It was believed that he was motivated by greed, that he wanted a large inheritance for himself, and that he murdered his adoptive parents, his adoptive sister, and her 2 sons. He's always maintained his innocence. We'll put website details on Facebook and on Twitter shortly, the website that Michael gave out a little bit earlier on. But I have to say, and I'm completely objective here, there are things that annoy me, Michael, things that annoy you, that do annoy me, and they should annoy anybody. And one of them, of course, is the finding of the silencer. And what's very interesting about that is that when, after the murders, his cousins, and apparently it's complicated, the financial affairs and the inheritance affairs of the family were kind of complicated because of the extended family, but the estate, apparently after the murders took place, it was conveyed to the extended family that Jeremy was going to sell the estate or land and buildings that were occupied by his cousins. And what's very interesting about that is that it was one of the cousins who found the silencer in the gun cupboard, the silencer with little bits of blood and paint on it, which obviously was like manna from heaven to the prosecution. Now, that's a kind of a Hollywood twist to the story, Michael, isn't it? I don't like that. You know, these people find out that the land they're on, the Jeremy is planning to sell it, and it's one of those people central to that that finds the silencer that is ultimately, you know, very, very prominent in securing the conviction of Jeremy. It doesn't sit well with me, that.
Well, it doesn't sit well with me, because if you look at the police logs, the police done a full search of the house,
couldn't find
the cupboards and everything, and then all of a sudden, then 3 weeks later, this silencer turns up. I mean, you know, and by one of the members of the family. I mean, you know, it's quite extraordinary when you think about it, because why didn't the police officer, when he searched the house, find it the first time?
It wouldn't have just been one police officer either.
It would have been a team of officers, you know. And I mean, I think this is the only thing which is keeping Jeremy in prison, is the silencer, to be honest with you. If you take away the silencer, you know, there is no evidence there against Jeremy. And, you know, to be fair with the silencer, you know, Jeremy hasn't got his fingerprints on it or anything. You know what I mean? So there's no doubt about it. There's something fishy has definitely gone on here with the silencer, because that police officer would have searched that house and he would have found it. Now, you can't just open a cupboard and go, oh, there it is, you know, 3 weeks later. I mean, that is an extraordinary piece of evidence which should be thrown out.
That has, do you know, that evokes the series making a Murderer about Stephen Avery.
Absolutely, I've seen
that. It's the same thing, isn't it? There was a similar thing where they couldn't find a weapon in a very small cabin, and combed the place for top to bottom and couldn't find it, but then conveniently found it some weeks later. Now, look, I'm not sitting here agreeing with Michael. What I'm saying is I don't like that. Michael, at the time, the national press should have really gone in very hard on the finding of the silencer after the police failed to find it, the finding of it by a cousin. How did the media report on that back in the day? Or was there some kind of sense that the media were so thrilled by the sensation that Jeremy had been implicated that the media had decided he was guilty from day one? What was it like?
Well, I think a lot of the media believed Jeremy was guilty from day one. They believed everything the police said, and they hanged on every word which the police officers were saying. You know, I mean, Jeremy didn't stand a chance. It was a very high profile case, as you're aware. You know, it reached international level news. I mean, when you look at it from that point of view, how are you going to defend yourself against it? Because you're already found guilty even before you stepped inside the dock. You know what I mean? So, I mean, he didn't get a fair trial. I can say that. Article 6 of the Human Rights Convention says you're entitled to a fair hearing within reasonable time, and to see all documents which is against, you know, everything which is against you. And to this day, all these documents still haven't been disclosed, even though there's a court order. I mean, so how could Jeremy have a fair trial? You know, the media convicted him as well way before the jury did. There's no doubt in my mind about that.
Talk to us again about that court order to release documents. Remind our listeners about that. Who's got the documents? What is it that you believe the documents might reveal, and why has the court order not been enforced?
Well, it was a court order. You know, the Court of Appeal ordered that all documents which Essex Police have got should be handed over to Jeremy's legal team. Now, they're making excuses up, saying they haven't got the manpower. Then we've heard excuses that, you know, they've lost the documents. They haven't got all the documents. And then there's just one excuse after the other why they're not complying with the order. And, you know, they are in contempt of court. And I'm not sure where we stand legally on getting the chief constable up before the court, but he should be. Because, you know, if there's a court order there by a judge, then who were they to ignore it? You know, and the thing is, Jeremy's alibi, which is the call from his father, the log, which is written down, with, you know, they've refused to disclose it. They've absolutely refused to disclose it. They accept that it exists, but refuse to disclose it. And it cannot be right, because that alibi from his father shows that Sheila Cafell was the one who was responsible for the murder and not Jeremy. I think it's very, very important.
This is the phone call.
Yeah, the phone call is very, very important.
It's vital because Jeremy contends that he was at home and Sheila, God love her, if Sheila did do it, I mean, she was mentally ill. If she did do it, heaven help everybody involved, but Jeremy says, got the phone call from Neville, my adopted dad. He tells me that it's all kicking off in the house. There should be a record of that. We talked about this earlier on. The police said no.
I don't think they're telling the truth. I think there must be a record of it somewhere.
Why would the police... do you know what it is, Michael? People will listen to this and they will look at the cousins and the family and they will think, right, this has got all the makings of a great noir thriller with a great twist. The family have stitched them up and people might say, we can buy into that. But they might be sceptical and say, what would the police have to gain by going along with it?
Well, what are the police have got to go along with it? I think it's a case of they've made up their minds, and once they make up their mind and they home in on somebody, like they did with me, the Birmingham Six, you know, the Birmingham Six were actually told, we don't care whether you're innocent.
Yeah.
You know, we've been told by people higher up that you will do. As long as they got bodies behind bars and they got somebody accountable for that, that's all they needed. And in the 80s, when Jeremy's case was going on, miscarriages were occurring, on a regular basis. They are still today, but I mean, the way they went about it in the 80s, it was an academic. It was across the country. And I just want to give you some statistics on how many people have been released since the Guildford's Four story broke in 1989. 85,000 people have been released by the Court of Appeal.
85,000. I did not know that, Michael. 85,000.
When I was working for the Innocence Project, which is a student-based organisation which is based in Cardiff, and in Bristol, when I was working for them, they got those statistics from the Court of Appeal. Now, most of these cases are mundane cases. The people wouldn't have heard of them. But at least 300 of them were high-profile cases.
Michael, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of tweets on this. Do remind us of the website, the Jeremy Bamber website. What is it again?
It's www.jeremy/bamber.co.uk. And if all the information is on there. There's quite a lot of information about some of the new evidence, but obviously, you know, we can't put all the evidence out there because of a pending appeal. You know, I do believe Jeremy's going to get an appeal. But, you know, if anybody wants to support us or support Jeremy, please go on the website, have a look at the evidence and make up your own mind. Don't read the newspaper reports from the early days because they're so biased. You know, it's unbelievable and it paints the wrong picture. And I just think it's so important that people make up their own minds on the evidence, not on what they've heard in the papers or on the radio.
Do you know, the media behaviour was pretty bad. You know, I've been a journalist for 20 years. I'm independent now with this programme, but you know, I've worked in commercial media, national media for a short time. I just want to remind our listeners, Michael O'Brien, Michael exonerated due to his own hard work when he was in prison for a murder he didn't commit, met Jeremy Bamber. Jeremy, one of the most notorious, one of the most infamous, one of the most famous, whichever word you want to use to describe it, murder cases in UK history. Huge coverage all over the world. It was massive news in the Republic of Ireland. Jeremy was convicted of murdering his family, five members of his family one night, shooting them. He was convicted of trying to blame his mentally ill adoptive sister for that. They said it was all about inheritance and it was all about money. He has always maintained his innocence, and there are anomalies and very uncomfortable facts surrounding the case, which, you know, again, I have no axe to grind here. I'm not representing anybody. I'm just the journalist. But I would go along with Michael and say that the whole case should be reviewed. It should be opened up again. I'll tell you something which bugs me, Michael, speaking about the media. Things that got reported, which really, use a bad word here, pissed me off, were when Jeremy was arrested, one of those cousins who, you know, stood to gain by Jeremy getting into trouble, was telling anecdotes, basically saying that, oh, once in the past, Jeremy said, I could kill anybody. I could easily kill my parents. That's, you know, hearsay nonsense that should not have been reported by the press in the way it was. Now, even if Jeremy said that, I would still say it shouldn't have been reported in the way that it was and sensationalised. You know, looking at it today, I spent hours today going over it again, knowing you were coming on, out of respect, obviously, for you. How could anybody say that he could get a fair trial, that a jury could sit there, listen to him, and say that they hadn't been swayed by or influenced by the media? I just don't buy it, Michael.
Well, that's the key issue, you know. I mean, when there's been police malpractice, you know, in other cases, and we try to get the police officers done, the first thing they scream about is, oh, we've had too much publicity, we can't get a fair hearing. Well, shouldn't that apply to Jeremy Bamber then? You know, you can't have it both ways, you know. And this is the thing, see, you know. Like, I know Jeremy wouldn't hurt a fly. He's not that type of person. I mean, and if you've got to know him, I mean, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but I was the prisoner who took the Ministry of Justice to court over access to journalists, so journalists can go and visit prisoners when they were claiming their innocence. They're still denying Jeremy Bamber that. And I think the reason why is because they're afraid that the public will find out Jeremy is not this monster which the papers have painted him, and they will see right through the lies which have been told.
The family, you know, he was disowned. He has no support whatsoever. I'm not trying to, you know, I'm not trying to make a point or score a point with this. I'm not, but I'm just saying that his family, even his biological parents, they won't have anything to do with him. He's a murderer. He belongs in prison. He should stay there for the rest of his life. Are you surprised by that all these years later, Michael, that there's not one or two of those who knew him that are in any way supportive of him?
Well, no, because they're going on what the police have said. You know, they're probably law-abiding people, and they probably, you know, are stuck in their ways. But, you know, can I just say this, you know, people like myself and Trudy Benjamin and other people who are working on a case, we're his family now. We're trying to get him out. We're a big family who believe that Jeremy is innocent, and we care about what happens to Jeremy, you know. We know he didn't do this crime. We've looked at the case throughout, and, you know, I hope this doesn't happen, but if I got to take it to the grave with me, I will always say that Jeremy Bamber did not do this crime, because I just know he didn't do it, you know? I know the person he is, I know his personality, you know? It's been said in the papers that he's a psychopath, and yet he's had tests done, and he's no psychopath, you know, or anything like that. He's got no traits whatsoever. And yet, you know, it keeps coming up time and time again, you know, and lies about Jeremy. And I mean, it really frustrates all of us campaigners when we see this nonsense, because, you know, we want justice, not just for Jeremy Bamber, but also for, you know, his family as well. And, you know, we know Sheila done it, and they've just got to be strong enough to admit that they've got it wrong. And I'm just hoping that the Criminal Cases Review Commission, who was going to look at the case again, will see that what we've been saying all along is true, that Jeremy is innocent. And we're just hoping that we can get an appeal and, you know, try and help Jeremy rebuild his life when he comes out.
1985, 1986, we're now in 2018. Obviously, technically, things have moved on a long way, and our listeners have been tweeting me, sending me messages. Richie, the Reuben Carter story, the hurricane, all these stories where men were able to use the advancement of technology to help them prove their innocence. Would all of that evidence still be in storage, all of that physical evidence? And has technology advanced to the point now where it could be reviewed and it could make very quick work of deciding that Jeremy is innocent?
Absolutely. There is forensic work going on at the moment, you know, where we've managed to, you know, most of the campaigners have managed to raise the money. And from what my understanding is, they're almost complete. And I mean, it clearly, all I can say is it does clearly back up what Jeremy is saying, you know, as I said, I can't go into the nitty-gritty of it, you know, for legal reasons.
Yeah.
But there is more evidence coming out time and time again. And I'm just hoping, you know, the lawyers now are going to get together with the Criminal Cases Review Commission and, you know, we're going to see the case referred back to the Court of Appeal where it rightly belongs.
So without saying too much, you're kind of saying that forensic work has been done, evidence has been re-examined, and it's looking favourable, is what you're saying.
Yes, I am saying that, yes.
You're certain of that?
I'm certain of that, yeah, because we raised the money for it, so I know we've got our own forensics to have a look at this particular case. So that's what the money's been spent on, to get the forensic work done. And from what my understanding is, it's positively in Jeremy's favour. But as I would like to exercise a little caution, because when it comes to the Court of Appeal, we've seen with the Birmingham Six, they had to have a number of appeals before they got out, even though there was strong evidence to clear them at the first appeal. So, you know, we're just hoping that we got three wise judges up the Court of Appeal when it does get referred, and they can see through this and see it for what it is. Because Jeremy is a victim of a miscarriage of justice. And if he does get out, he will be the biggest miscarriages of justice victim this country has ever seen. 33 years. I mean, it's extraordinary.
He was a young man when he went in. I mean, he's not an old man now, but I mean, he's lost. I mean, if he's innocent, and you believe very strongly that he is, and I know the group does, and I know many people do, if he is, you just can't even fathom that, Mike. I can't imagine it. You know, I spent some time when I was younger in hospital, and I'm not trying to make light of this, I'm not trying to make a joke of this, and it was a fever hospital, and it was dreadful. I didn't see anybody for 4, 5, 6 days. It was only 4, 5 or 6 days, and I couldn't believe, I nearly climbed the walls. I mean, I remember it vividly. And you spent 11 years in a place, locked up, no freedom, can't see your family, can't be with your children, can't be with your wife. I can't even begin to try and comprehend what it was like. You know, we can't imagine being without a television, Michael. Isn't it amazing? This is how lazy and how vacuous we've become. We can't go 5 minutes without our phone or a computer or a TV. If we're told to sit in a room for 20 minutes without them, we'd be absolutely going up the walls. You spent years in prison for something you didn't do. And if he's innocent, as you say he is, 33 years is just unconscionable. I can't imagine it. Can't imagine it.
Well, I did 11 years and 43 days, and I thought my miscarriage of justice was bad, but I mean, this has got to be one of the biggest miscarriages of justice Britain has ever seen, you know, next to the Birmingham Six, I would say, the Guildford Four. You know, I would put it on the same par as them. I mean, they've done a long time, and they were treated badly, you know, and I mean, the way Jeremy's been treated by the media, you know what I mean, you know, he didn't have a chance. You know, and I'm just hoping a lot of your listeners who've listened to me tonight will look at the website, look at the evidence, and if they want more questions, we're prepared to any questions they want to fire at us, we've got an answer for straight away, because we know he hasn't done it, and the evidence is there if people want to see it. So I do hope, you know, after the show that, you know, if they want to join the campaign from wherever they are in the world, it doesn't matter where they are, you know, we would love their support. You know, we have to right this terrible, terrible wrong which has been done to Jeremy, you know, and I'm doing everything I can. I just hope many other people will join us.
No doubt. No doubt about it. Just a couple of questions before we part company, Michael. Listeners have been asking me to put to you. Those who worked the case, you know, the detectives and the police have worked the case, have any of them ever given any hint or any indication at all that they were looking back kind of unsatisfied with the way it turned out? Has anybody ever said anything like that?
Not that far as I'm aware, but unless we look at these documents, which is not under the non-disclosure, which we haven't had, we don't know. We might have police officers who might have said things like this, that they're concerned about Jeremy's case and might have made statements to that effect. We don't know. This is why they got to disclose everything to us, because there could be some police officers, and I'm sure quietly some police officers are saying that, you know, Jeremy is innocent, but it's more than their job's worth to come out and publicly say it, because there's a knock-on effect. They will lose their jobs, then they will lose, if they got a mortgage or something like that on their house, you know, they just financially put pressure on them because they haven't got the money to pay the mortgage. Then it puts pressure on the marriage, and then it's like a domino effect, and the wife walks out on them with the children, and they're left in a poxy flat sometimes for whistleblowing, if you like. So there's, you know, there's reasons why police officers don't come forward.
I agree with that. It could also be argued that if Jeremy is innocent and things went badly wrong in the investigation, as you believe they did, it could also be, and again, I'm not trying to be the devil's advocate. I say this because I mean it. It could just have been clumsy and a poorly managed investigation. That can also be argued, Michael. What do you think?
Well, you know, I suppose, you know, in theory it could be argued that, but then when the chief constable is denying you documents, which you know they have, which could clear his name, that is a deliberate act to stop somebody from trying to clear their name. That is disgusting. That is appalling. It should, you know, we're not in the 1800s now. Like, you know, we're, as you pointed out, we're in 2018. You've got to have transparency. You know, and if there's any documents there, which the chief constable knows full well it is, they should be handed over. And if it clears Jeremy Bamber's name, they have to do the right thing. You know, and, you know, so I don't think there's a case we can argue that, you know, they acted in good faith, but they got it all wrong. They're deliberately denying him access to these documents.
Yeah, that's
with
an
a court
outrage.
Order.
That is
and
an
that's
outrage.
The issue, isn't it?
What about political interest in this? You know, you would imagine that the, you know, the progressive mob at the Labour Party, they should be very interested in the fact that a court order has been issued for the release of information, and it hasn't been. Has there been any political interest in this, Michael?
Well, I believe so. I believe there's some magistrates who've exercised their concern. I know Peter Thatchell. I don't know if you know
Peter's
who he is.
Yeah, Peter's a great man.
Yeah, I mean, amazing man.
Brilliant.
He's wrote to the chief constable. There's been many other people who've wrote to the chief constable, and they keep... They either ignore or they try to make excuses why they can't disclose it. And I mean, their reasoning is not right, you know, because there's a court order there. Never mind making excuses up. They can find the resources to get the evidence to convict people, but they can't find the resources to clear an innocent man. That is ludicrous.
And it might.
You know, how can they get away with that?
And if he is innocent, and it's proven that he is, as you and his supporters believe, it could be incredibly costly, of course, for the taxpayer, because you could be talking telephone numbers in terms of a compensation payout, which, of course, he would be entitled to. You know, I remember interviewing Paul Hill many years ago, and, you know, we were talking about compensation. And Paul said, look, there's no amount of money, and I know whatever... I know you got your settlement with the police, but I doubt very much, Michael, it compensates you for the loss of those 11 years with your family. No amount of money will do that. But the taxpayer should be interested in this and should say, well, hang on a second, release everything that you have. There are sufficient concerns that warrant the opening of the case again and having it looked at again. So bloody well do it, and do it quick, and find out one way or the other, because ultimately it's Joe Public that has to foot the bill for it if Jeremy gets 10, 15 million quid further down the road, you know?
I totally agree, and I'll give you an example. It costs about £40,000 to £50,000 to keep a prisoner in jail for a year. I mean, so when you look at he's been in for 33 years at £50,000, say we took it at the bottom end of £40,000, that's an astronomical amount of money of keeping an innocent man in prison. And that's without, if he gets his name cleared, what they've got to pay on top. But one interesting thing your listeners might know is when you get compensation from the Home Office, they deduct bed and board off your compensation, like as if you wanted to be there in the first place.
You're having a laugh.
And this is what they deducted out of my compensation, £37,500, and said I would have paid that on food and water while I was outside, and the press called it the bed and board case. Because they charged me for my bed and board while I was in prison.
I did not know that. So they agreed to a sum. You came to an agreement with them, the 300K, and those lousers came back and said, oh, by the way, you've got to now pay for the 11 years you're in prison.
That's what they did. They deducted from my compensation from the Home Office.
Jesus,
I had 675,000 from the Home Office and 300,000 from the police. But the Home Office was the ones who deducted it. And it's still law today.
My
so when
God.
Jeremy comes out, say, for instance, he was awarded, say, 15 million, right? They would put a percentage of that he would have to pay back for his food and water whilst he was in prison.
My mouth.
Not even guilty people get charged for their bed and board when they keep going in three or four times. They don't get charged nothing.
My mouth is hanging open. I didn't know that. That is extraordinary. What level of malevolence, what level of sickening, lunatic bureaucracy? That's just disgusting, that. We are the reason you're in prison. You shouldn't have been there. You were deprived of your liberty, your family for all those years. Oh, by the way, now you can pay us for keeping you. Mother of God.
That's what they done to us. They said we would have, on the outside, we would have had to pay for meals and water. And I said, I flippantly sent a letter to the Home Office saying, are you going to charge me for my council tax bill next? Are you owe my water rates? You know, where's it going to end? You know, I mean, when my lawyer first told me about this, I laughed because I thought it was so ludicrous. No court in the land would accept this. But unfortunately, we took it all the way to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords said, well, I'm sorry, you have to pay the bed and board, whether you like it or not.
Well, you were lucky that there was somebody awake in the House of Lords to even give you that stupid answer. Most of those clowns sleep their way through their days for £300 a day. Don't get me started on that one. But it's a
That's
fact.
Another day.
That's another day. We could do a show on that. Michael's website is michaelaobrien.com. You've been listening to a truly remarkable, selfless human being, wrongfully locked up himself for years. Who could even imagine what it felt like? And he managed to come through it. And he now helps others who are fighting to have their cases opened again, including Jeremy Bamber, as we've been talking about. Michael, I gave your website details. Remind us, finally, of the Jeremy Bamber website, please.
It's www.jeremy/bamber.co.uk.
That's Jeremy. That's Jeremy hyphen Bamber, isn't it? .co.uk.
Yeah, hyphen Bamber, yes.
That's the one. And I urge people to go there. And I urge people to join in the conversation to demand that this case is opened up again, regardless of whether you might think, oh, well, I still think he did it at the end of the day. Even if you think that, there is sufficient evidence and sufficient concern there for it to be looked at again, regardless of what your own personal opinion is. Michael, I meant when I said it was an honour to speak to you. It's been a tonic speaking to you, and I hope that you and the other campaigners are successful and that serious light is thrown on this again, one way or the other, because it deserves it. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate
it. No, you're very welcome.
I enjoyed it. And we'll stay in touch with you, of course. If there's anything to report, any news, anything positive, anything one way or the other, please do come back on the programme and update us on it.
I certainly will. Thank you very much.
It was an honour. Thank you. Michael O'Brien, live there on the line to us from his home in Wales, speaking about the case of Jeremy Bamber, which was a massive television event, even back in the mid-80s when we didn't have Sky News or we didn't have BBC News 24. There was enormous media coverage of the case. It was so unusual and it was so, you know, it was so bloody in the details. It was so graphic of this man whom allegedly murdered his family over inheritance. If you listen to Michael O'Brien there talking about the many questions, the many unanswered questions, the many anomalies around the case, you know, court orders not being honoured, not being executed for documents to be released, the phone call that the police said never was from Jeremy's adoptive father calling him to say your sister has gone berserk, the cousin finding the silencer. There's so much to this. You heard Michael say there that, you know, forensic examination has taken place because of the efforts of the team, jeremy-bamber.co.uk, the efforts of those people, and using the funding they've raised, and that he did say to us there that the results are, what they have so far is favourable to Jeremy. I mean, it must be the case that all these years later, with the sophisticated DNA mapping that we can do today, that all of that evidence can be looked at again and should be able to conclusively say very quickly whether Jeremy was there, whether he did the shooting or whether he didn't. But amazing listening to that. And like I said, Michael's own case is a remarkable case, locked up for a murder that he didn't do, that he had nothing to do with for over 11 years and 43 days, I think he said to me, wasn't it? 11 years and 43 days, came out. And imagine the awfulness of the Home Office saying, well, we were complicit in your wrongful conviction. Here's 600 and odd thousand pounds. But by the way, we're going to take 37 grand or whatever it was back from you for your bed and board while you were wrongfully imprisoned. What sort of sick, putrid, vile, disgusting system tolerates that? They should have given him his own island in the Irish Sea, not be taking money off him for bed and board. Mother of God. We're going to take a break. When we come back, lots more to talk about. Your tweets as well. This is Tuesday's Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. Terrific to be on Fab 2. We're on triggerwarning.tv, richieallen.co.uk, and the programme is on TuneIn Radio and, of course, Spotify and iTunes and all the rest of it. Back in a minute.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Richie Allen.
Welcome back to the programme. Massive amount of tweets came in there. Charlotte asks a good question. Charlotte, she says, Richie, could you ask Michael what the main struggles were that he found to adjust to in real life once released? Didn't get time, Charlotte, to get into that, but I'd like to speak to Michael more about his own case in the future. But I've interviewed men, as I said before. I interviewed John Thompson, who's very famous. John set up a group called Resurrection After Exoneration. His case was just unbelievable. I met John when I was in Spain many years ago, when I came back to radio. And John was fitted up by a corrupt district attorney who really wanted to put him away. John was a bit of a troublemaker. He was, in Ireland, we'd say he was kind of a contrary type of guy. He was a guy that didn't fit in, and he was opinionated, and he was mouthy, and he would have a few drinks, and he would get into trouble from time to time, but nothing serious. He wasn't violent. He wouldn't have been beating anybody up, and he certainly wouldn't have been doing anything like that. But he was a bit of a nuisance, and that's how he was seen anyway. By his local police. But he was arrested for a murder that he had nothing to do with, based on a dodgy eyewitness. And they didn't like him and they wanted to convict him for it. And some way into trying to fit, once they decided that John committed this murder, and they were trying to fit pieces around it to back up their case. The district attorney was presented with blood evidence that proved that John couldn't have done it, right? So what happened? He buried it. John was found guilty and was sentenced to death by lethal injection, and he came very close to it on two occasions. On two occasions, he came within days. In fact, on one occasion, I think he came within 24 hours of going to the chamber until a stay was granted. And eventually, John's story is very Hollywood, but it's true. Eventually, a nosy human rights lawyer took up interest in the case and was able to find this blood evidence and prove that John couldn't have done it. But you won't be surprised to learn that the district attorney wasn't fired, didn't resign, and was never charged with anything. And John Thompson never got a penny in compensation, despite the fact that he'd come within a hair's breadth away from the death chamber. This is the level of... So when Michael O'Brien and the supporters of Jeremy Bamber say that, you know, there are people in the know who know that Jeremy Bamber is innocent. No, I'm not saying that Jeremy Bamber is innocent. I'm not saying that because I don't know. I'd love to see the case reopened, but I don't know. I'm not saying he is innocent. But when you hear these cases, when you see what was done to the Birmingham Six and to the Guildford Four and many other men and women, I think, didn't Michael say 85,000 cases since his own case, I think, since he was exonerated, 85,000 people have been found to be not guilty after they were handed a custodial sentence. So you can understand why they say, well, I believe he was fitted up, or I believe there are people who know that he is innocent and could exonerate him, but choose not to do so for selfish reasons, reasons of self-protection. So you can understand why they think that, because it has happened time and time again in the justice system in this country. You know, many years ago, I used to, I mentioned this on the programme some years ago when the programme first started, I used to write to death row inmates as a teenager. And wasn't because I was kind of morbid or because I had a kind of a macabre personality. I didn't. I came across, believe it or not, in a Boy and Cell magazine. I'm sure you've read the Boy and Cell. We've all read Boy and Cell. We've all picked up stuff in the Boy and Cell. There was an ad in the Irish edition of this magazine for pen pals, for people in Jacksonville in Florida on death row. And I began writing to men over there when I was 13, 14 years old to be a pen pal, basically, because the advertisement said these men were desperate for people to correspond with because they spent a lot of time corresponding on their cases, but they didn't have much time for hearing from people. So I used to write to a number of people, one of them being a guy called Cleo Douglas Delacroix, who was on death row for murder. What happened was, in Cleo's case, he was with two guys one night in some part of Miami, I think, as far as I remember, and they robbed a petrol station, and the guy running the petrol station was brave, and he tried to defend his takings, his night's takings, and the cigarettes and God knows what else they were trying to steal. And in the meantime, he struggled with them, and a gun went off, and he was shot in the chest, and he bled to death and died. Now, it was shown that it was manslaughter, that there wasn't necessarily any intent to kill him. He was killed in the struggle. But what happened was Cleo's two mates did what, this disgusting thing that happens in the American justice system. They copped a plea. They pled guilty to a lesser charge and pointed a finger at Cleo and said, well, he was holding the gun. Even though he maintained he wasn't holding the gun, he ended up in prison, and he was executed. you know, and I was horrified by that. I was horrified by capital punishment and by miscarriages of justice. And, you know, I read stories about people like Reuben Carter long before those films were made and Denzel Washington played himself. I've always been interested in this. And I spent a long time today, as I should do, as you would expect me to do, looking over the circumstances around the arrest of Jeremy Bamber, his ex-girlfriend making the claim that he had admitted to her that he did it, the silencer and all of that. And it doesn't sit right with me. And I also don't believe that any self-respecting person could honestly say, back in 1986, that they could be impartial. I don't think there was a juror, I don't think there was a man or woman in the country who could have said with a straight face, yes, I can sit on this jury because I don't know anything about this case, or I haven't formed an opinion on it. I think it's nonsense. I don't think he could have, even if he is guilty, I don't think he could have gotten a fair trial. And I think there's a lot there that needs to be looked up and looked at. Go to jeremy-bamber.co.uk, jeremy-bamber.co.uk. And like I said, regardless of your own personal opinions on it, and I have to mention again that his adopted family and extended family have no time for him. They are certain that he did it. And his biological parents, who gave him up for adoption, have said they are certain that he did. I'm just saying that for the record because it's out there. I don't want to be accused of coming down on one side or the other. I don't know. I don't have any, like I said, dog in the fight. But I would open that again tomorrow in a heartbeat based on some of the information that already exists there, you know. But, the whole capital punishment thing, if you've been reading your newspapers over the last few months, it has been mooted again by various people, usually on the right, saying that, you know, we should look again at capital punishment. And they've often used terrorism as a kind of a road into discussing it. You know, what happened in Manchester in May, of course, 22 people were killed terribly. Some of the things that happened in London. There has been this kind of rolling, kind of gathering movement again to say, well, if we catch any of these guys before they, you know, either kill themselves or before they are shot down by the police, we should have, on the statute books, we should have capital punishment as an option. But of course we shouldn't have, ever. And Michael O'Brien is living proof of the fact that the death penalty is madness, it's lunacy. Because if the death penalty was around when Michael was convicted, he wouldn't be around. You know, he wouldn't be here talking about Jeremy Bamber or the Guildford 4 or the Birmingham 6 or anybody. You know, Michael was convicted back in 1987. You know, capital punishment worked pretty quickly in the UK. There was no 15 years on death row like we've seen in the US. He would have been executed within a couple of months. That would have been the end of him. Until years later. Jesus. He never did it. I don't understand people who want to see people executed. Even the worst people in the world, you know. Lock them up for a long, long time. But don't get into executing them. You become as bad as they are if you advocate stuff like that. That's my opinion. It's 17 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show for Tuesday, 13th of February 2018. Here's some David Bowie for you. I believe it's over a year or nearly a year. Is it nearly a year, over a year since David Bowie died? This is the Young Americans, back with more of your tweets and more comment in a couple of minutes. Thanks for staying with the program.
They pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down. He frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed her then and there. She took his ring. Took his babies. It took him minutes. Took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken.
Young American,
she was the young American.
Oh. President Nixon. Do you remember the bills you have to pay? Or even yesterday? Have you been on America? Just you and your idol symbols.
Questions mainstream journalists will never ask. This is your Richie Allen Show on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, and triggerwarning.tv.
Welcome back. Time is flying. Time has flown by. Big thanks to everybody who is working on the campaign at jeremy-bamber.co.uk. Thanks to them for their kind words on Twitter. I really appreciate that. The programme was set up to talk about issues like this, but to talk about them in depth in a way that they won't talk about them on mainstream media. It's not the virtue signal here. It's not about that. But the whole point of programmes like this is to kind of have a more of an in-depth conversation, a more reasonable conversation about these issues. There's too much in that. You can't speak about that in a 6-minute interview on BBC Radio 4 or BBC Radio 5. You can't get into it, the intricacies of it, of stories like that. So you can't. And that's the reason why this programme exists, is to give more time and to have a more measured approach to these issues. So there you are. Lot of tweets on it. A lot of tweets expressing, I suppose, kind of similar sentiments to mine. People a little bit, you know, uncomfortable with some of the facts of the case. Not getting too much of a sense of what you think in terms of, do you think that Michael and the team are right? Do you think that Jeremy is probably innocent? Do you think he's not? Let me know one way or the other. Deborah tweets, thanks for highlighting that case. I wasn't that familiar with it, she says. Thanks for that. I do appreciate that, Deborah. Huge case. I mean, huge. Like I said, 12, 13 at the time when it was major news. And, I mean, I was an anorak. Even at that age, I genuinely was reading newspapers. You know, I wasn't reading the sports pages. I was genuinely interested in what was going on. And I would have been reading all about that at the time. Moinga tweets, what's the name of the guy whose case was messed with, by the district attorney who messed with the evidence? John Thompson, look for resurrection after exoneration. You'll find out all about John there. Alex Doust tweets, the death penalty for the worst criminals is wrong. Dying is easy. It's living that's hard, especially the way prisoners are made to live. Yeah, I agree with that. I've never agreed with capital punishment. I used to have arguments. Obviously, if you're in broadcasting, you will meet people who argue with you. And I was confronted on a radio program many years ago by a man whose son was senselessly and violently murdered by a real bad bastard. And, you know, he said to me, how can you say that? You know, it's never happened to you. And I had to listen to that and I had to respect him quite rightly. And I said, well, look, of course I don't know. I wouldn't even pretend to know. And maybe if it ever happened to me that somebody I cared for was, you know, cut down like that, I would want revenge. Of course I probably would. My only argument is the state should not be exacting revenge on behalf of people. The state should be completely dispassionate. And the state should be, or should attempt to be, logical at all times, not passionate, not exacting retribution on behalf of people. It shouldn't do that. You know, if the gentleman whose son had been murdered, if that gentleman had managed to get to the killer being easily identifiable, of course, and exact his own revenge before the police got involved, I couldn't say I condone that, but I would understand that. And I wouldn't see any need to lock the man up for 15 years for murder. You know, that's hot-blooded. It's emotional. You can understand that, but you can't accept or understand the state saying that they should take retribution or revenge on behalf of somebody. You should never do that. And thankfully in this country, and thankfully in the Republic of Ireland, my country, there is no capital punishment. I mean, when you look around the world, and I mean, isn't it funny, over the last 2 days, Sky News have been running these propaganda pieces for Saudi Arabia. This garbage makes you want to vomit about how Saudi Arabia is going to modernise, and it's got a sexy young prince that everybody loves, and he takes selfies with the population. And women are going to football matches now. And women are going to drive. Saudi Arabia is going to change. It is in my arse. It's never going to change. They're still beheading people. The state in or on football pitches in Riyadh on a Saturday afternoon, based on flimsy evidence, based on accusations of, you know, he traffics drugs, or he takes drugs, or he does this, or he does that, or sedition, or whatever. Beheading them in public, making guys kneel down on football pitches in broad daylight in front of people. Lunacy. Sky News saying, oh, our correspondent went to Saudi Arabia. It's all on the up and up there. It's rubbish journalism. It's a hellhole, Saudi Arabia. It is a shithole, is what it is. There's a country that, as we speak, is raining hellfire and brimstone down on Yemeni men, women and children. And Sky News are saying it's going to become a moderate, secular... Don't get me started. Don't get me started. Hi to Siobhan McConville. Siobhan, nice to know you were listening to the programme tonight. To Liz Froud as well. To Karen... So many people expressed revulsion that Michael O'Brien was asked to pay for his keep, having been kept in prison for 11 years for something he didn't do. They deducted from his compensation money, the Home Office, the money that they spent on keeping him in prison. That's the sort of thing, you know. It's driven many of you absolutely mad. To see the tweets coming into the programme, go to twitter.com and put Richie Allen Show, all one word, in Twitter. Press enter and you'll see what other people are tweeting to me there. Hi to Martin Coombs. How you doing, Martin? Martin was joking earlier on. He was only joking about Benjamin Netanyahu. Martin is on the same page. We shouldn't ultimately be calling for anybody's execution. Never. Because you never know when you've gotten it wrong. You never know when you've gotten it wrong. Right, I think we're just about to run out of time. Thanks for listening to the programme today. I will, of course, be back with you tomorrow, Wednesday at 7 p.m. UK time, where we'll have two guests and we'll have a varied show with different topics. And, of course, on Thursday as well. Do stay in touch with richieallen.co.uk. I posted articles there today. And why is my mind gone blank? I wrote the articles. They weren't ghost written. It was me. Yeah, I wrote an article today about, you know, they've been campaigning for morality clauses to be inserted into your employment contract, whereby your employers might fire you because of something you said on Facebook or something you did in your private life. There's an article on there about that. There's also an article on there about weather modification and Ireland and the Weather Modification Treaty of 1977 in Geneva. So there are interesting things on there to read, to disagree with, to argue with. You can go on the forums on richieallen.co.uk and you can argue the toss there. Thanks again to Michael O'Brien. MichaelAOBrien.com. The Jeremy Bamber website is jeremy-bamber.co.uk. I have retweeted a change.org petition. Please sign the petition, because whatever you think, even if you think ultimately he might have done it, there are problems with the conviction. There are problems with the case. Do sign the change.org petition. Let's get that case opened up again. Leaving you and loving you with Mumford & Sons. Thanks for listening. Speak tomorrow. Until then, bye for now. Look after yourselves and one another.
And in the middle of the night, I may watch you go. There'll be no value in the strength of walls that I've grown. There'll be no comfort in the shade of the shadows thrown. But I'd be yours, you'd be mine. Stretch out my life and pick the seams out. Take what you like, but close my ears and eyes. Watch me stumble.